give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Massey and Paul. This is episode 11 of season 2. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back to the start and listen from episode 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. The show does contain film spoilers, so if you've not seen the film yet, I would advise watching it first. It might help you understand a little bit better. Now for today's show, I hope you enjoy. So today, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Mark Cooper, a full-time Games Promotion Officer in Dublin with St. Oliver Plunkett's currently, and you've had many, many clubs before that, Mark. Thanks very much for taking your time to come on with us.
Thanks so much for having me. Pleasure.
Good, and thanks, Massey and Paul, as always.
How are you, Colm?
How are things, lads?
Hiya, Mark.
Hi, how are you, lads? Can I ask a question before we start?
Go on.
Probably for most of the rest of the listeners listening as well. Where's the quiz gone from the end of the show?
I'm going to ask you a question first, Mark.
Yeah.
Who won overall at the quiz?
Who did the most cheating, like?
No, who won the quiz?
I would have said Paul.
Well, you would be wrong there.
Well,
and as a result of Paul losing, we decided not to go at the quiz again.
So, Mossy, Mark, you are correct. I was ahead. And with about another 4 or 5 episodes recorded, and I'd won them all. And just to save a bit of face for Mossy, I asked him, you know what? We'll knock this in the head. I'm not really getting any great pleasure out of baiting you week in, week out.
Colm, tell the truth there.
That's a Rudy Giuliani comment there from Paul. No basis, no facts to back up his statement.
Fake news, Paul.
Fake news, yeah. Do you know what? We just said we're actually going to have a super quiz at the end of season 2, so we'll compile it all.
Look forward to that.
So, Mark, we're watching The Blind Side. I suppose a film on American football and about a player who comes from the wrong side of the tracks, I suppose, and he's given an opportunity on the perceived right side of the tracks, and it leads to a bit of stardom from. What attracted you to the film yourself?
Honestly?
Well, yeah.
Well, I liked the idea of it, but obviously Sandra Bullock would have been the main draw at the start. I would have been a big fan from Speed, and obviously, Miss Congeniality did fairly well in the box office as well. So, I suppose the whole story behind it, like the fact that it was kind of a true story and stuff, kind of pulled me to it at the start as well, you know.
Yeah, and what do you think of the film in total, in general?
I liked it. I think probably the sporting side of things, from a coaching side of things, was probably weak enough from the coach, Coach Cotton, I think his name was. Mm-hmm. But I liked the whole idea of the development of the person, Michael Orr himself, away from the pitch, and like I say, his background and the opportunities that he was afforded and the stuff that he missed out on because of where he was from, and ultimately he got from the kindness of strangers in the end, you know.
Yeah. Massey, what do you reckon of the film? Thoughts?
To be honest with you, I was listening to the Steve Kerr and Pete Carroll podcast during the summer, and they had the writer of the book, Michael Lewis, on, and actually ordered the book during the summer and read it and really, really enjoyed the book. Great book. Then the film, after reading the book, was a little bit of a disappointment for me. It was more like a TV movie, if you get me. Mm-hmm. Still like past the time, like, but and the story of it was good, but if you get the opportunity to read the book, it's very good.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
Yeah, look, I enjoyed it as a film. I wouldn't necessarily go and watch it again. Definitely not from a coaching perspective. There isn't a huge amount in it. I suppose it's a feel good story from the off, and there's some interesting points to take from it, you know, and trying to get a greater understanding of the athlete is important in it, you know.
I read the book as well before. I actually read the book before the film a couple of years ago, and I don't know, Massey, you probably, if you can agree with me, but I kind of had a picture of Mike Orr being way, way bigger than what he actually was.
Yeah, like, I thought he was going to be a monster completely.
Yeah, I don't know how true the film is and what size your man is in the film, but he's 6'4 in real life and he's about 300 pounds. But just from the book, you kind of got this way larger than life perception of what he was. And I suppose what he was when he was playing and how dominant he was and stuff like that.
Yeah, but, I think also from the book, it like showed more of his athletic ability rather than just his size. As well, how quick his feet were and for size he was, what he was able to do. And even with a basketball and stuff. So it was, book is well worth to read. But like, they just had to cram it all, I suppose, the book. You had to cram it all into 2 hours. So a lot was skipped over there, but.
Yeah, and I suppose, look, the main part of the film, from our perspective, like I know we spoke about Coach Cotton, but a lot of it is to do with Leanne's input as, I suppose, a mentor in life, like, isn't it?
Like, she was, like, his everything at the end of the film. Like, she was the one who pushed for him to come to stay in the house. She pushed for his education, for him to improve. And she also pushed him to be the best athlete he possibly could be. She integrated him into the family where he like was like the scene where he was invited in for the Christmas card scene just showed that he was part of the family there and then. But she was a very strong character. I'd say, Paul, you wouldn't want to cross her.
No, I wouldn't be crossing her now. I'd be very much the submissive in that relationship.
Like you say, Mossy, she was actually the first person who took an interest in him as a person, as opposed to the people in the school trying to get him in because he was potentially someone who would be a benefit to them from a sporting point of view. Like, she asked him, like, everyone calls you Big Mike, you know, and he said, look, I hate being called Big Mike. He said, okay, I'll call you Michael from now on, you know. So everyone else was calling him Big Mike and just hadn't really an interest in him as a person, but she was definitely the first person who looked after him as opposed to just trying to get something back off him, you know.
Yeah, and you know what, that's a real interesting one, and I'd actually forgotten about it. Giving someone a nickname that they don't particularly like and it's a nickname imposed on them can actually be detrimental to their development. And like some people, like nicknames by and large are designed to be somewhat funny, and it can be funny affectionate or funny cruel. And like, I know when one of the first teams I ever had, there was a young lad on it called him Stomper, right? Because of the way he ran, it wasn't the most elegant type of running. And obviously the young lads, this year you're talking under 12, under 13, and the young lads were calling them Stomper, whatever. And as a management team, we were a young enough management team. We weren't a whole lot older than the lads who were there. We started calling them Stomper as well. And I remember being kind of pulled up on it, not to be calling people nicknames that mightn't necessarily be the most appropriate.
It's something that I do myself, to be honest with you. I ask somebody what they'd like to be called. I don't like to be calling someone their nickname until you get like permission to do so, more or less, because you don't know, as you say, is it a positive thing or a negative thing.
You kind of wait for someone else to do it first, Mossy, and then just kind of, so if I was calling Colin Collie, you'd kind of go off the back of that as opposed to you calling him Collie first kind of thing.
Yeah, what I'd also do is I'd nearly call him his first name and just ask him, just go directly to them and say, what do you want me to call? Do you want me to call Colin or Collie or what is it? And I nearly just ask I do ask the player themselves what they wish to be called, because some people just, as you said, do not like their nicknames.
I suppose, like, especially in that kind of American football where the panel is so big, I suppose even knowing their actual name is massive sometimes, as opposed to calling them by their number, you know?
Yeah, big time. Like, it's like you, like even you going around coaching in schools there, you're going coaching, what, hundreds of different children a week. It's very hard for you to know everybody's name. But like, once you do know their name, like, it makes the child feel great. Like, oh, geez, Mark said hello to me today, or he knew my name or something like that. It's it's a big thing, your name. Like we mentioned before in the podcast, your name is a big thing to a child. It's very, very important, and it's very important that you call it the way they want it to be called.
Yeah, do you know what? There's actually a really interesting tool that I'd recommend for coaches to use, if at all possible, right? Arizona State University Observation Instrument, so ASUOI. And what it is a list of 14 different behaviors that a coach could do in a training session or in a match. And if they audio record themselves or someone else moves alongside them and records it, you can see like there's stuff like instruction, like pre-instruction, concurrent instruction, post-exercise instruction, pray is scold, and a number of other things. And use of first names and is in there as well. Coach can get huge benefit out of a bit of reflective listening back to themselves in that sort of scenario, just recording themselves on their phone or dictaphone. Because I know, certainly when I done it, I had an impression of what I was saying in a training session, and it wasn't what I was saying in a training session at all. And I don't know if my behavior has completely shifted since, but creating some amount of an awareness can be really important there. And like, if you do realize that, you know, I am using first names well, or I'm using questioning, or I'm using an awful lot of scold, it can be a really good learning tool.
There was a good, actually, on this Bubble podcast, a guest on, he's with the IRFU, an Australian dude.
Nick Wilferman, is it?
I can't think of his name now, but he talked directly about what you're on about there, Paul, about the use of language when you're coaching. And did you get much of a shock when you heard yourself back?
Yeah, like, and you know what, it is a difficult thing to do. And like, if you're being honest with yourself and you were to assess yourself and your perception yourself to what actual reality was, I'd be rating myself considerably be lower than the perception I had of myself. And like, you talk about that language and the different language used. Like, so in the film, there was one really main coaching scene, and Coach Cotton used his language to deliver his message to Big Mike, or Michael, as we might call him, just so we're not offending him, right?
In case he's listening in.
He could be. He'll be tagged in the tweets. That's a fact.
We have a strong bunch of American listeners.
So he had his message and way of delivering what he wanted Mike to do. Mike didn't understand. So his method the second time was to say what he said the first time louder. So like, obviously that's no use. Whereas Leanne stomps in her high heels and sorts everything out by using language and using, we'll say, situational factors that he understood, which was brilliant. Like,
talk to me more about that then, like as in the different ways of communicating to players. Like, obviously we talk about, and it's come up in, I'd say, every second podcast, that you have to get to know the players. And if you know the players, communication obviously will come easier, because if you know, you can talk to some players on a slightly different tone as you can talk to others. Like, and like dealing with kids, like, how important is that to be aware? Like, and especially, like, I know Mark in your job and Mossy in schools and stuff, and at all our former jobs, GPOs, we might only get to know kids. Well, we only get to see them for half an hour a week in a school.
Like, there was actually a really, really, it's probably a throwaway thing, but there was a, the teachers were in the staff room at one stage and they were talking about Big Mike, you know, and one of the teachers said that she pulled a note or something out of the bin that he had wrote. And it was just three or four lines. And basically what it said was, it said, this was Michael writing it, "The teachers do not know that I have no idea what they are talking about. They give me homework and expect me to do it all myself. I have never done homework before in my life." That for me kind of just goes straight back to the coaching side of things. You know, people are asking him to do things that he has no concept of how to do them, you know. And like I say, if it's Coach Cotton telling them one thing and it not working, for him not to have the wherewithal to try to change the style or the method where he's delivering to try to get the message in from, like, you know.
But when you're talking to, when you're coaching kids, you're talking about use of language there and coaching adults, like, you do have to communicate differently with the groups you're dealing with, and you have to probably be age appropriate also with the groups you're dealing with. What works well for an adult team may not work whatsoever when you're coaching an under 12 or 14 team. So just be very careful with your wording and that your players understand what you're talking about. There's no point talking for the sake of talking. What's the good one that Paddy Butler says? 30 seconds max, and 20 seconds of that is actually vomit when you're trying to explain something across to children.
Yeah, look, you're 100% right. And I suppose all of us have worked in that environment where you're teaching young kids, and we need to employ different sort of language to get the same message across the exact same message across to different people. And for some people, trying to do a demonstration of a catch, it might be just enough for them to see us do it, and then they're, that's great. For others, then it might be a case where you actually you use your hands and physically help them into a position to catch the ball. For others, you might talk about the W, or if they're catching the stomach, a bread basket, or whatever terminology you want to use, you know. But using different phrases for the same thing is important, you know. Sorry, when I say that's probably contradictory to other stuff we said previously. Like, it's good to have a language that's the same all the time, but you might need to alter it for some of the others just to make sure that the message is landing. If you get me drift. Yeah,
consistent with teams, basically.
Yeah, but consistent, but then being also able to
change it, adapt it from a different team. Yeah.
It goes back to, there was a comment in Road Trip, I don't know if any of you are familiar with that film.
But great film.
At the end of it, they're on the way back to do the exam, and he's going, oh my God, like, the exam is 24 hours, how am I going to do it? And the genius in the group says, it's about application. Like, we can use philosophy. You like pro wrestling, so let's talk about the Royal Rumble. So the Royal Rumble was something, and you could see it in the, like, what Leanne did is she said, that's your family. You have to protect the quarterback because he's now your family. So that's how you treat it. So you put stuff into examples that he can understand. And for a lot of kids, it's also the same, you know. Like, as I said, you talked to Paul, like, you can just tell some kids or show them and they'll understand. But you can tell other kids in a quick phrase that mightn't be exactly applicable to something you tell every kid, but they might understand it. And it's important to find the commonality, I suppose, between the coach and the player in that situation where there is a misunderstanding.
Whatever happened to Tom Green?
God only knows.
Remember him? He was in Road Trip. I was mad into him around that time, and he had a great show and just disappeared.
He was on a podcast actually just this week, a pretty famous podcast, on Joe Rogan's podcast. He's traveling around America in a camper van on his own with his dog.
Okay.
Very good.
We might get in contact with him and see what his favorite film is and try and get him on board.
That's it. I'd say a lot of his stuff was fairly risque.
He was Freddy Got Fingered. He was in that, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Again. What was the name? Do you want Amy Smart?
That's right. Good man, Massey. Bye.
Yeah. Well, I wonder whatever happened to her.
Well, you know what? From going talking about Amy Smart and Mark talking about Miss Congeniality earlier on, we're telling you that we're showing how sophisticated we are as a group.
Yeah, all I'd say is I know whose wives and girlfriends are not listening to the show or don't regularly listen. But look, I suppose, like, Michael, obviously, look, he came from a situation, I used the word wrong side of the tracks earlier on, and it's something like you'd hear in a lot of American movies about parts of town and stuff like that. But he was given the opportunity in a supportive family who were obviously supportive of him as a person and as a player in sport. And like, if he didn't get that opportunity, would he have ever played in the NFL or ever played in college level even? And like, is it important that, I suppose, the players have that kind of, I know we talk about the environment a lot of time, but like, even the part of town where they might get a bit more opportunities.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's a really, really interesting point. And Paul, you probably heard of her before. A girl in Dublin, our senator, Lynn Ruan.
Yeah.
She was on the Blind Boy podcast a couple of times and a couple of years ago. And I remember listening to her, and she was talking about a few different things and how people from different areas have different, I suppose, opportunities afforded some and stuff. Like, you know, she was saying that, I don't know if it was her own child now, but she had a little girl when she was pretty young. But so when her kid was going into TY and stuff, that if for instance, that they wanted to be a vet or a doctor, if you were from a more affluent area, that you might be more plugged into those kind of networks and know someone who could set you up with, and stuff like that, you know. But it's an interesting topic, and she kind of talked about it. And she actually did very, very well. So I don't know, was she just the president of the student union in Trinity as well?
Yeah.
But she said, if you haven't heard of her before, if you haven't listened to her, I definitely recommend you listen to her after listening to all of these podcasts. But definitely, I'd be something that interests me. I suppose what you have and what you don't have because of where you're from, you know?
Yeah, and you know what? She was on one of the recent episodes, Lodging with Lucy as well.
Yes, she was.
Now we're just waiting for Colm to add in a strange kind of nuanced bit of television or movie there now, and all four of us are home.
Colm will just go back to his Disney movies. He's safe enough.
Be all right. Nothing wrong with it. But like, that's interesting. Like, does where you come from give you different opportunities? Like the GA is a community organization. Like every community in the country has a GA club.
No, it doesn't. I disagree with you on that now, Colm. There's very few places in the country that actually have GA clubs. There's lots of places scattered around the country that have Gaelic football clubs. And then there's a couple of small places where there's hurling clubs, and then there's GAA clubs. So it's not something that is afforded to everyone.
Yeah, it's the opportunity of being able to play. Like, you may have a very talented hurler who mightn't ever get the opportunity to play because he's born in Dublin, for example. He might be able to fulfill his potential. So, but you might, I'll go back there again because I'm sure that'll be edited out.
No, that's still it.
Like you said, you'd be born on, you could be, have a talent or something, but you might never get the opportunity to show that talent or get the opportunity to develop it because you're born in the wrong place. And Paul is right in what he's saying. Like, there's like plenty of places throughout the country that have no interest in Gaelic football or no interest in hurling. They have interest in one or the other. And you could be the most fantastic Gaelic footballer. Like, what's that fella who's gone to Australia from Kilkenny? Joyce?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't think of his first name. Like, he got his football. Dara Joyce. So he got his football in from New Ross, the school New Ross. That's where he played to his level that he was able to play for in Ireland. But if he stayed at home in Ireland, he would probably have to move county to play at the highest level that he could possibly play.
But he probably would have played intercounty hurling for Kilkenny, Mass, because he was a three-year Kilkenny minor hurler.
Yeah, but I'm talking about football, though.
Yeah. Well, Kilkenny have a senior football team. Junior football team. Yeah, but I suppose, look, I know what you're saying.
You know, it's a strange one, because then you get people like Mark there who don't even know what hurling is, and it's on his doorstep.
Yeah, well, look. It's only for the people who aren't good at football, isn't it? Or the other way around.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
It's the other way around, all right, yeah.
Yeah. No, football was always I played both, in fairness, now till I was minor, and then I wasn't that good at it anymore, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, but you know what? You got the opportunity at least, Mark, you know? Like, you were able to pick or choose whether you wanted to play football or hurling. And there's a number of players, like, I know in your club, and all the big, large clubs in Dublin where they're either footballers or hurlers, but they would have played both for all of their juvenile lives. Like, And Paul, I suppose it is interesting what you're saying, that there might be a football club as opposed to a GA club or a hurling club. But
that happens, like, in across every sport. Like, you look at the Irish rugby team, for example, like, it's dominated by, well, the Irish-born players, not the ones who come in from other countries. The Irish-born players are dominated by people who went to private schools. And, like, there's plenty of players around the country who probably didn't have the opportunity to play and probably be every good as, if not better, than the players who are playing there if they played this sport all their life. And vice versa, some of these Irish rugby players might never played Gaelic games, and they could have been excellent at it and adapted very well to that as well. So it's just your environment, really. You look at all the players who are in the inner city who don't really have the opportunity to play Gaelic games, who are absolutely fantastic athletes, but they don't get the chance to play their rugby or their Gaelic games, let's be honest about it, but they thrive at football, soccer. You look at, like, the majority of players around the world who play soccer professionally are coming from working class areas. I think there was one Brazilian, well, it might have changed now, one Brazilian capped soccer player who came from a middle-class background, and that was the first one, was Kaká. And that's not that long ago. Like, they all came from poor backgrounds. So that's the opportunity, what they got to play, and they pushed on, you know, where if you come from the, what's to say, other side of town, you might get the opportunity to play other sports, or you might not have the desire to push yourself.
Just on that then, Master, right? I was talking to someone involved with a different sport a couple of years ago, and there was two players going giving it a lash at professional level, and they came from slightly different backgrounds. And this fella said to me before, like in the first 3 months of this project, let's say, that he said, player A will stick it out and player B won't. And I said, what makes you think that? And he goes, player A has to stick it out. If he doesn't stick it out, he's nothing to go back to, kind of. Whereas player B might be a small bit more of an affluent. So like, sometimes the player who might want it or need it more mightn't be the one from the perceived better background. Like,
yeah, no, definitely to have that bit between their teeth. Like, it's as in Michael Orr's case, like he had football and that family lifestyle, or he could have stayed where he went to the party at the end and succumbed to the lifestyle of the drug dealers and the crackheads and stuff like that. So it's a fine line, really, isn't it, between some of these players who make it and those who don't.
But like, I think they say in America, 1/6 of players good enough to play in college don't make it in American football because they're coming from backgrounds where, like as Michael Orr, he was struggling with his academic side of it. And you have 1/6 of their potential playing population don't even make it to that grade because they're just in an environment that doesn't support it.
Doesn't suit them, doesn't suit their needs.
What's, just out of curiosity, Colm, you'd be into the NFL a lot more than I would. What's the shelf life of the average NFL player?
I don't know, it's 3 years or something like that. The average fella, yeah, they're kind of, once they go to rookie contracts, the pay scale, they have to get paid more than once they get out of the rookie scale contracts, and they get paid more and they can just bring in someone as fresh. And the injuries and stuff like that is massive. The same in rugby and in the rest of the world, like the high level contacts and the crashing and colliding, the big fellas get looked after, they get the best of treatments and stuff like that. But like if you're the third string quarterback and you get a bad injury, you're not going to get the same resources put to you that Drew Brees is getting. Like,
you can be replaced easily.
Yeah, that's the thing. You're easily replaced when you're at that level. Like,
but also there's an outrageous stat where the amount of professional athletes and American football players that go broke in their first couple of years after retiring, it's just ridiculous because they're not able to handle the money, not able to handle the fame. They just don't know how to look after themselves.
Another thing there on backgrounds and the type of players, do you think the type of area you come from has an impact on, and the type of area you come from and your background, your home, has an impact on how you play the game? So like, I suppose North Dublin football teams, North County Dublin football teams, like, are always considered to be hardy out and aggressive and strong. And then maybe wrongly so, some of the South Dublin clubs.
Soft South Dublin clubs.
To be soft, yeah.
Like the Crumlin and the like.
Well, it wasn't actually talking about that.
Yeah, as you say, Paul, like there's definitely if you talk, let's say, whoever you want to talk about, like some of the bigger clubs, you say, do you know what, they're soft or they're windy or whatever. But if you're playing whatever, I don't want to say any of the names of the clubs, but some of the stronger or kind of more the rougher clubs, you know, like that there's almost like a fear factor there before you even start, you know. But yeah, like even us, like we would always be traditionally seen as like a soft team or a windy team. Like, how'd you get rid of that kind of? How'd you get rid of that kind of? That tag, I suppose.
It's hard to get rid of until you actually start winning things. Like them South Dublin hurling clubs that you would have, I'd say, Paul has referenced to. Like, you couldn't really call them soft anymore.
No, definitely not.
He couldn't whatsoever, like they, and it's a matter of like producing on the pitch, getting rid of the tag. Like Ballyboden were in how many finals in a row before they, or sorry, how many finals were they in before they actually won one? And once they won one, like they started to like win plenty and produce some really tough, hard players. Like, look at Conal Keeney there. Like, how many years is he playing championship?
Is it 17 or no, is it 20? Is this his 20th year playing intercounty senior?
Close to 90. And like, he's just a hard man. Like,
But like, is a lot of that false as well? Like, is it just the old stigma that has been passed on from generation to generation? Because like, if I said to you, you know, lads, you're going up and you're playing Rush up in St. Mars, St. Mars up in Rush, like the old stigma about that was, oh, geez, a bunch of farmers, you know? And sure, I'd say, no, a few of them probably pick strawberries during the summer when they're for a summer job. Like, I'd say not one of them. Like, and I know from being out there, I wouldn't perceive them to be anything like that. And is that just an old age perception, like that, ah, this crowd are soft? Like you can, like, we can all think of clubs that are perceived as soft in our own counties, and like, but are they really soft? Like, or is it just a perception that, Jesus, ah, they lost again? Yeah, they're soft. But sure, Jesus, there's only one team wins every year. Like, they all can't be.
That's perception. And you're going to have that perception until you actually win things.
I don't know if it's the same in other counties there. Like, I would, and I could be completely wrong in this now, I would have a perception within Cork that maybe Douglas would be a soft enough club. Yet they have a lot of players on the county hurling and football panels. And then you look at it, Blackrock dogged out a county senior championship this year, and they only really got players onto the senior hurling team after they won the county. Would there be any?
Didn't have anyone in the county senior team. Did nobody on the county senior team. But you know what? I think a lot of it comes back to as well is the perceived affluence of an area, that Douglas would be a perceived well-off part of Cork in comparison, let's say, to a Northside club. And I think when we talk about clubs that are soft, we kind of look at that a small bit, that it's easy for the people that, let's say, feed, might have a chip on their shoulder, geez, you know, like, you know, they always get players in the county team and they've won nothing or stuff like that. But is that perception, like, as I said, is it coming from a person that deems themselves inferior in some other capacity? That, as I said, is it an affluence thing? Like, when we talk about clubs that are tough, we'll probably talk about clubs that might be perceived less well-off areas. And is that why we deem them soft and tough? Is because they're coming from a slightly more different, or they might have to work a little bit harder to get where they are.
But as a coach as well, if maybe there is then perceptions about a team that might be true, might not be true. Like, if I went into an area that, a club that were perceived to be soft or whatever, you might spend an extra bit of time working on, we'll say, combative stuff where they are aggressive and in your face on the training ground, and hopefully that would lead to materialising in matches, you know, that kind of way, by creating that environment that they are building up that resilience and toughness in training.
Is that not just, like you say, that's good coaching, that's smart coaching, that's knowing who you're playing, knowing their weaknesses, knowing their strengths, and like I say, going for that perceived weakness, and if it is there, you're obviously going to show it up, and if it's not, well, at least you had a cut at it, you know?
And like, you go back there, get perceptions about clubs and stuff. Like, you always hear about, not so much in Dublin because it's an urban area, but like, when you're in the country, like, they're a towny team. They're a towny team. Like, they're soft. They're flashy. When things are going well, they're flying. But when things are going bad, you expect them to start fighting amongst themselves or fighting with the referee or whatever it is. It is perception. Like, I'm sure we can all name clubs there now, and it's just from reputation, say, oh, they're going to start fighting with themselves if things aren't going well.
Matthew, like, I remember when we were younger, we would have in Cork, we would have had set divisions. So let's say I would have played for Inkilla in East Cork, and you would have had the City Division, you would have had two North Cork divisions, you would have had kind of four down West Cork. But playing the City teams, there was that kind of a thing, you know, that, Jesus, these guys are going to be tough, you know, anything could happen here. And there was a small bit of a fear factor, but I remember under 16, we played one of those teams in a county quarterfinal, and it ended up with the match being abandoned. They had three fellas sent off. We'd one fellas sent off. All merciful row broke out, you know. But We got past that match. It was the first time we would have played a City team in a competitive match, let's say. And once we got past that day, we never had a bother against the City team again. But that's psychological edge, you know. They had an edge match.
What age group is this at?
Under 16.
Right.
And like, we played them in a replay, and we beat them in a replay. But the replay, right, was actually furred, like, was they had to go past our place to get to the place where the replay was on. So there's also okay. this thing of the city teams, and same, I'd imagine, Massey, when you're talking about town yeah. teams in the country, the further they have to travel, the harder it is for them to get a result. And like I know from colleges, yeah. colleges hurling as well, like, and geez, we played above in Sligo, and we used to play the Ulster and or the UUC and Queens nearly every year, one of them home, one in away. But the chances were we lost up there and we'd win the home game, regardless of which one it was. And it was just that even them, like the further they had to travel away out of their comfort zone and the further we had to travel away out of their comfort zone. Because you imagine a fella from Cork going up to Belfast for the first time ever and you're hearing the trouble, you're hearing about all those stuff before and you're not knowing, geez, it doesn't make a difference. All the difference is that there's a different colour line on the side of the road.
Yeah, that's it.
You know,
like we used to be going out, and one of our coaches underage, like I would have been a city club, would have been like I've been from just outside the town. But his team talk would be, these lads be out here eating their bacon and cabbage, you're eating your chips.
driving trenches and their tractors and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that gets thrown around about Rush, actually. I remember somebody said that. I should also be driving to the matches in their tractors and run the 14 games.
Yeah.
So like back to the movie then, like when you've Mike, let's say, and his chronological age was 17 or 18, but his psychological age obviously wasn't at that level, you know. He found it very difficult in the film to even converse with other people, and he found SJ was probably his most valued companion, who was probably 10 years his junior. Like, it's an important thing to be conscious of, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, like within whatever team you're training. If you're training an underage team, and we'll say you're dealing with, I'm just going to use an under 12 team, right? So immediately they're at a difficult age because they're transitioning from primary school into secondary school, going from the situation where they're the big dog in primary school to being the run to the litter, for want of a better expression, come secondary school, right? But you're also then dealing within that, we'll say, a 2 year either side physical age situation, we'll say, where one of them could be physically developed at the rate of a 10-year-old, another one could be at 14. So you have a 4 year gap there. And then you have others who, as you said, like Michael Orr, their psychological age is really young. So he's down at that 10-year-old age group. Age where then there's other who are 14 and might be dabbling into some certain stuff that they shouldn't be at that age. So you're dealing with, like, that under 12 team, you could be dealing with a lad who still believes in certain things, and then another lad who's off maybe drinking at the weekend.
They say that he ranked in the 98th percentile, I think it was, for protective instincts.
Yeah.
How in the name of God do you measure that?
I think that was a throwaway line from her, though, was it?
No. There's tests. Like, they're kind of aptitude tests. Like, what would you do in this situation? Or which of these, it might be a question, and which of these would you do, you know? So things like that. I'd imagine that's how they get them, because he was, as I said, he was 3% in one, he was 5% in the other, I think he was 6% in the other, and they were all kind of intellectual things more so.
Yeah, I was thinking the same myself, Mark. I would love to know how some of them things are measured. I'd imagine it's just a standard test, and whatever answers you input in, it spits out whatever results it spits out, probably.
I suppose, like, look, well, I know we're not going to have GA clubs going around doing those tests, but to have an idea of the type of personality that a player is might give you an idea of what position that might be best suited for them as well. Because we spoke about it last week in Moneyball, about how there was one club that I know for the under eights, they just did a bit of basic eye test on what skills they have. Are you good at blocking the ball on the ground? Are you good at doing the block down? Are you good at striking the ball? Blah, blah, blah. And there was one player who they always put a fullback in, kind of a big Mike character, put him at fullback, but he was afraid of blocking someone down. And they acknowledged that in quickly, and they said, right, if we leave him there, he's not going to play in 12 months' time. So like being conscious of those things is important. Anything else to add in the film?
Had he played football before that at any stage? No,
first foray. And I think, you know what, it probably, like, when you look at, I know you mentioned about soccer, there might be very strong in inner city and large towns and stuff like that in Ireland. I think basketball was that kind of sport in America, that it was more accessible to the less well-off areas, that everybody could play basketball, but playing American football because of the, even buying the equipment and stuff like that would be an inhibitory factor.
Yeah, it depends. It just depends on what part of America you're from as well. Like there was, as one of the drug dealers said in the film, like they played such and such a league. It was like just in different leagues, but he just never had played the game. Like he had to be shown how to play it. And remember going back to the film when he didn't show any, in his first training session where he didn't show any, let's just say any potential. Things weren't working out well from like the coach had lost interest with him straight away. He said, why did I waste my all his efforts to get him into the school on him, because he didn't see him as a player until Leanne got her claws into him.
And like he did when you mentioned basketball there, he did win all state honors in the basketball as well. Like, so it just shows that people with that, I'm not going to say natural ability, but who are adept at playing sport can change sports, because of the skills that it was provided.
Lawrence Taylor was the player they're on about. He was in what film did we? What Any film was Sunday? He in? Any Given Sunday.
Was he in The Waterboy as well? No, that was somebody else.
Well, here, it's some amount of similarities with The Waterboy, right? So Michael Orr doing a bit of visualization to get across the line, right? To when he was getting ready for tackles or whatever, similar to Bobby Boucher. Katie Bates, there in both of them. And that kind of orange strip of Tennessee was the same color as the Mud Dogs as well. So,
and the manager the coach to the whole mess came from the same part of Louisiana that the Waterboy was set in.
Boom, it's a rip off of the Waterboy.
Now, it did send me down a serious wormhole
with the coaches or what?
So I always check in IMDb just to see what other films are in. And Tim McGraw.
Yeah.
So I said, I have to listen to his song with Nelly. So put me in that. So that's been in my head for the whole weekend. And then Collins Toohey. Do you know who she is in real life?
Who? Collins?
Collins, yeah.
It's Lily
Phil Collins. Phil Collins's daughter. So I've been listening to Phil Collins all weekend.
I had to watch her TV show there a few weeks ago with herself. Emily in Paris. Give it a miss, lads.
No,
hang on. Go back to that there now, Colm.
Yeah, so we're after getting all four in there. But it's not Emily in Paris. It's Emily in Paris.
Sorry.
You know what? You just lacked a little bit of je ne sais quoi that some of the rest of us have, you know?
Sorry, Paul. It's been my background to have I wasn't given the same opportunities as you. Right, any favorite scenes or lines from the movie that we haven't gone through already?
I like CJ, the young lad.
SJ.
Sean Jr.
Yeah.
When he is, CJ was the one in Baywatch, Pam Anderson's character. SJ. SJ, when he was coaching him on the table with the salt and the pepper and the sauces and stuff. I thought that was a good scene. Mm-hmm. And he was a very good character.
Yeah.
Sean Jr.
Yeah.
I liked it when it was a Thanksgiving dinner that Michael had gone to. It was his first meal with the family, and he's just shoving bread rolls in his pocket.
That's like O'Brien at a Sunday morning buffet in a hotel, stuffing all the pastries in Jacinta's handbag.
Some slander.
I'd prefer if you weren't mentioning her name on the podcast.
Okay.
Paul, and he, and if anything stands out for you now?
Yeah, you know, similar enough to Massey, I really enjoyed SJ, the character, and like his coaching montage was a good bit of scenes as well. Justin generally was great.
Where would it rank in the montage list for you?
Yeah, it's up there. It's up there. It's better than some of the other ones we've seen, so fair play to him. Like you have to admire Leanne and how ballsy she is, and we'll say a lot of the conflict she had with people, you know.
Mm. Yeah, I think one of my favorite parts was when she rang up the head coach during the first match and told him to start running the ball. First of all, what coach leaves the phone on and answers it to some random number during the match? But anyway, it's a story for another day. What else did I say? Oh, yeah, the comment I was saying about road trip earlier on, what he said to him was, I can teach you ancient philosophy in 46 hours. I can teach a monkey in 46 hours. You just have to find a way to relate to the material. So you like pro wrestling, don't you? And your man says, yeah. And he goes, Socrates was like the Vince McMahon of philosophy. And what did he say? And the 20-man battle royale is about participation explains prediction, Aristotle. So that was the...
What part of the film was that in, Colin?
Very end of Road Trip, Mass. Just before so the bomb.
Okay.
Just before the bomb thing. So, rank it. What are we here? Who are we commenting on here? Is it Leanne? Are we judging Leanne? Or are we judging Coach Cotton? Because
we'll judge Coach Cotton.
We're judging Coach Cotton?
Yeah.
Okay, what are you giving him so, Mass?
Not very much. I'm going to give him a 1.5. And the reason he get that mark is that because he progressed his career on the results of Michael Orr.
Yeah, I would have went slightly lower than that, even, to be honest with you. Like, I think the only plus was he actually got Michael into the school in the first place. It was ultimately for a selfish reason. Now, he kind of said at the start when he was meeting the board or whatever that, look, you should let him in, not because he plays sport, but because it's the right thing to do. But then ultimately he was trying to just kind of progress his own kind of coaching career, I suppose, you know. But I would have just given him one. I wouldn't have been a huge fan of him now, to be honest with you. I would have been a bigger fan of Miss Dewey.
Paul, what are you giving Coach Cotton?
Coach Cotton, I'm going to give him a 1.5. As Mark said, he did get him in, and maybe there was a bit of, it wasn't always for the right reasons, but at least he did get me into the school. And when Leanne came over and gave the we'll say the different communications to Mike to get him on board, and he went over to ask her, well, how do you get that done to an extent? I actually like that element of it as well, but not a whole lot else. But look, he was getting wins as well, and
so. Oh my God. Well, he got the results and he got one of his players to the NFL. So I'm gonna give him a 2, just in the point of view of look, flawed as a coach, I think better probably as a scout. He was able to identify talent, and like in fairness, he moved him from the D line to the O line as well. So it took a while probably to get that sorted, but wasn't a bad guy, willing to adapt and learn as he went on. So I'll give him a 2. So that's it. Gwan, what would you give Leanne if you'd give her out of 5?
Yeah, she was brilliant. In fairness, like, you know, she gave Michael a home, a family, like a new adopted family. Literally, she adopted them. She got his driving license. You know, she got me to school. She was really, really good. There wasn't too many negatives looking at her. Like, you know, like dealing with Michael at all. So
go on, Massey. What are you giving?
I would give her a 4.
Okay, and Paul.
Yeah, look, she was great. I'm gonna give her a 4.5. She developed them every which way, like as we'll say, as that person, as that academic student, as that athlete. And look, obviously it's a story and it's fudged from what actually happened, but you wouldn't imagine it's that far away if Michael Orr was giving any comment into it. You know, look, fair play to them. Fair play to her.
Yeah, I'll give her 4.1, so she'll balance out there about 4.2. Lovely stuff. Mark, thanks very much for your time, man. Much appreciated. Anything to plug long time or listener. Sell or talk about, or where can people find you if they have any questions for you?
No, nothing to sell. Just doing the Movember at the moment to raise a bit of awareness for men's health and stuff like that, you know. So a few years ago, I had a bit of a run-in with the Big C. So, just keep talking, lads, you know.
Stuff back.
What we might do is share on your Movember link there for anyone who wants to contribute. I know it'll be December.
Brilliant.
December to whatever it is when it's out, but still, we'll get it out. Thanks, Massey. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Colin.
Thanks, lads. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review of your favorite platform, and if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Roy Orbison Tattoo, and we appreciate any likes, retweets, and comments. Next week, we will be watching Good Will Hunting, and we'll have the show available first thing Tuesday morning, as always. Thanks, everybody.